WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Everyone knows that movies cost millions and make millions, and that we're paying a lot more for tickets than we used to. But did you ever wonder how the box office take is split among the theaters, the studios, the artists, and the video stores? Our next guest, Edward J. Epstein, has spent years figuring out the finances of the movie business, and he says power relationships in Hollywood explain a lot about why movies follow predictable formulas and why independent films are hard to make and hard to get into theaters. And Epstein's new book, The Hollywood Economist, has other fascinating insights, like how cup holders on seats drive up revenue, how states and some foreign countries subsidize studios, and why most multiplex theaters have 299 seats. That's because 300 would trigger a requirement of the Americans for Disabilities Act that every row be wheelchair accessible. Edward J. Epstein is an investigative journalist who's written books on subjects from the Kennedy assassination to the diamond industry. I spoke to him recently about his new book, The Hollywood Economist, The Hidden Financial Realities Behind the Movies. Well, Edward J. Epstein, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, movies once captivated the American public. The audience was enormous. Give us a sense of how much the American public was watching movies decades ago, back, say, in the 40s, as compared to how often we go today.
In the 1940s, it was the national pastime. Approximately 67%, two-thirds of the American public, every week, on the average, went to a movie, and they didn't just simply see a movie. They saw newsreels, they saw cartoons, animation, shorts, a second feature, but it was their weekly pastime. Today, less than 10% of the public, on the average, go to the movies in a week. Now, even with movies like Avatar, they score enormous numbers, but the percentage still doesn't go above 10%. They take their numbers from other movies that are playing at other theaters. You still have less than 10% of the population, and it's been this way for the last 10 years.
You know, one of the differences between the movie business today and, you know, 40 or 50 years ago was that there were fewer theaters, bigger audiences, and bigger screens. Now you have multiplexes with, you know, thousands of screens, which means that studios have to produce thousands of prints of their films. Is that a significant expense?
Well, prints now cost roughly, people use the number $1,000 a print. It could be more or less. But so if you're doing 5,000 prints, it's $5 million. Now, if you're doing Avatar, it's not a significant cost. If you're doing a film like Hurt Locker, in which case, you know, your total box office is $8 million, it'll wipe out your entire box office. So it's a significant cost, not as significant as advertising.
But they actually do make actual films on reels. These aren't simply digital computer files that we're seeing in theaters, right?
It's interesting you raised that point, Dave, because now when films are shown digitally, there's a digital file. But the movie companies, the studios, the distributors, whatever we're going to call them, still charge, although this is not something they make public, they still charge the film for what they call a digital copy, even though the digital copy, rather than $1,000, might cost them $50. And they then contribute the money for the digital copies of the movie to help the theaters convert from analog projectors to digital projectors. So they have a basic scam going on, and that is charging for something that doesn't exist. Now, what happens is it adds to the deficit of the individual movies, but helps all the studios together by helping the theaters to convert to digital, which will, in the future, reduce their cost.
So the studio makes a movie, and then its distributor, which is a subsidiary of the same studio, charges a fee, which includes high costs for prints of the movie, which aren't really the major cost, but it's a way of extracting revenue from the film, right, that then gets used to convert the theaters to digital projection.
In the case of digital projection, that's true. In the case of analog projection, which is still the majority of theaters, they actually make a print, but they get a footage allowance from the film labs, which they get back at the end of the year if they use a certain amount of footage. And that reduces their cost by 10 or 20%, which just goes into their treasury and doesn't go to the account of the film. The films are all set up, the titles are set up as off-the-books corporation for the purpose of simply accounting on the film. The actual flow of money into a studio is very different from the money that is credited to the film.
Now, you're right that studios don't really make a lot of money from the box office. I mean, a lot of it goes to the theater owners and to the distributors and to the advertising and printing costs. So where do they make their money if it's not from their theater audience?
Well, the reality of the movie business is very simple. They have a library of movies, of literally thousands of titles. Those titles they can sell over and over again to television stations, to cable networks, to paid television, to put them on video. Now, of course, it's DVD. License them to games. This brings in a steady and major flow of money, which pays for their entire production, the money that they actually earn from the ancillary rights to a movie. And these rights, to keep them flowing, and it's worldwide, it's global, it's not just America, to keep the money flowing in, they need hit movies because they, when they sell a package, and they sell these movies not individually, but they'll sell 20 movies to a paid television network or to a foreign television network, they need a few hits, big hits like Batman or Avatar or whatever you have to drive the package through the whole system. And they make their money by basically selling the same product over and over again through different platforms. The beginning, it all opens with the theater and the box office. Now, you know, if we go back to the 1940s or earlier, all the money came from the box office. So people still think in terms of the box office as the heart of the business. But that all changed in the 50s when television came in. Now you have 90% of your audience at home, basically, watching television or watching their computer or watching their DVD machine or whatever they have there. And because of that, the studios have to have a means of reaching the home audience as well as the audience that actually gets into a car and comes to a movie theater.
What about product placements in films? Is that a major source of revenue?
It's not a major source of revenue to the studios, but it's helpful, especially in independent movies, where people get free computers and free cars to use. They don't get the cars to take home, but they get cars to use during the production, airplane tickets. It helps reduce the budget of a movie. It isn't a major source of money. What is a major source of money is government subsidies. That could, or even state or city subsidies in America, that could reduce your budget by 25% or 30%. Product placement is more or less, a nice freebie that comes on top of everything else. It's the cream in the coffee, if you like.
Now, when a movie is being made, one of the risks is that an actor or actress will walk off the set, get ill, get injured. What kind of insurance do they have for stars?
Well, you can't make a movie, at least a movie where you have any sort of independent financing, unless you have cast insurance. Cast insurance says that if any of your major players, could be the director or the stars, are incapacitated, the insurance company will compensate you fully, even if it means scrapping the entire production. You'll get back every penny, including script development cost. It's a very expensive cast insurance. It could be 5% of your budget.
Are there some stars that have higher premiums because they have a way of not finishing films?
Well, yes. The insurance companies, one of the things they do is evaluate risk. They're not fools, and they look at every aspect of a star's history, whether they've taken drugs, whether they've been trouble with the police, anything, whether they had an injured arm or leg, anything that might reoccur. I mean, because, again, insurance companies are risking hundreds of millions of dollars in the case of some major films like Terminator 3 against a few million dollars in premium. So they want to make sure that the stars don't do stunts, that not that the stars would do the stunts normally, but they want to make sure that doesn't happen. They want to make sure that the stars don't expose themselves to any risk by playing any sports during the movie or even driving a car in some cases. And they want to make sure that they won't suddenly disappear.
We're speaking with Edward J. Epstein. His new book is The Hollywood Economist. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guest is writer Edward J. Epstein. He writes about the economics of Hollywood. His new book is called The Hollywood Economist. You've written about how difficult it is for independent films to get financed and to find an audience. And I know that when I read, sometimes when I watch films that are described as independent films, it will say that they are distributed, in fact, by one of the big studio names that we know, you know, Paramount or Warner Brothers. What do we mean when we say an independent film?
An independent film is a film that does not have a studio green light. Studios might later pick it up to distribute. They might buy it at a film festival. Sony has an entire division, Sony Classics, which buys films essentially at film festivals, nowadays not paying more than $2 million a movie. But an independent film, the major difference between an independent and a studio film is a studio film has a distribution date the day it is greenlit, the day it goes into production. When Wall Street 2 went into production in September of 2009, it knew that it was going to be released April 23rd of 2010. When an independent movie is made, it has no distribution and no distribution date. So it might have to go to film festivals. It might be years later before it gets distributed or might never get distributed. For that reason, it's much harder raising money if you don't know when the money is ever going to be returned to you.
Right. So an independent film, when it's made, there is no assurance that a major studio will distribute it. So how do people finance independent films?
Well, there's been many different attempts to finance independent movies. Sometimes it's rich people finance independent movies. People like William Randolph Hearst made films back in the 1920s. For a long time, they were financed by selling the rights to the film in foreign territories, Germany, France, Japan. And by selling those rights and then borrowing money on the contract that they would be paid for those rights, they were able to finance the movies. But this has become exceedingly difficult in the last few years. And this year, 2010, it's almost impossible to find enough pre-sales to finance a movie.
So in other words, you would sell the assurance that once a film finishes its American run, that the foreign rights would belong to whoever is putting up the financing, and then use that promissory note, in effect, to get a bank loan or some other kind of investment. But you don't really know at that point what kind of success it'll have and whether it'll have a foreign audience, do you?
Well, you don't, you know, if you're a foreign distributor, you don't have to put up any money. You just sign an agreement that if the film is finished and if it plays, sometimes as a contract it has to play in American theaters, you will put up so much money for the rights to that territory, let's say Germany. So you agree to pay $10 million for the German rights to the movie if it's delivered. Then the movie producer has to go to a bank and say, I would like to borrow $10 million on this note. The bank would say, well, how do we know it'll be finished? Then you have to get a completion bond from essentially an insurance company, which says that we guarantee that the movie will be finished. And that bond might cost you another $1 million. So it's a very complex process, raising money. And this process has been made much more difficult recently because of the end of, say, the DVD market abroad or the shrinking of it abroad. The end of independent distributors in America, so people are no longer sure the movie will be released in America, so foreign distributors don't want it, and the growth of local film industry, all these things have come together. So these days, it's very hard to finance a film other than from investors or angels, or however we want to describe people who are willing to risk money for the pleasure of seeing a film made.
You know, it's a little discouraging as I listen to you describe how all this works and how the studios want to get a teen audience to justify the, you know, tens of millions in advertising and distribution costs that they will incur, and how hard it is for independent producers to get financing to get a film made. Do you think the overall the quality of cinema has been degraded by the finances?
I do think that the quality of movies have been juvenilized, if not degraded, have brought down in their age level and their intelligence by the requisites and the realities of what a studio needs to do to keep money flowing in. You know, I think that everyone in Hollywood would like to make socially relevant and intelligent movies. These are intelligent people in Hollywood, and they would like to make movies like Quentin Tarantino makes. They'd like to make really good movies. The problem is they know that they need an audience to come to the theaters that they can find, and that audience tends to be teenage and high school students and people that basically want action in movies. So more and more, they produce the movies that will produce the audience they need, and somehow they hope that a little money will be available to make the Hurt Lockers or the other movies that they would really prefer to make if they had their way about it, if they had the ability to do what they wanted to do.
Well, Edward J. Epstein, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Edward J. Epstein's book is The Hollywood Economist. You can read the first chapter on our website, freshair.npr.org.